fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Each year, the Southern Poverty Law Center releases its annual report on hate groups actively operating throughout the country. In its most recent report, the SPLC identified 15 such organizations in Wisconsin. Their members seek to normalize abominable behavior, marginalizing groups based on their skin color, religion, gender identity, or ethnic origin. In Wisconsin, the list includes anti-Muslim groups, neo-Nazis, an anti-LGBT church, Black nationalist and white nationalist organizations. 7 of the 15 organizations operate statewide. Others in Wisconsin are located in communities throughout the region. And experts say the actual number of active hate groups is probably higher as members increasingly take their operations underground. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Hate is nothing new. But according to the SPLC, hate crimes and participation in hate groups has risen significantly in recent years. It's part of a nationwide trend that's creating tension in communities, schools, and workplaces. Today, we examine hate in North Central Wisconsin, asking several key questions. What motivates people to join? And why do they stay? And how do members of such groups finally leave? Joining us today is Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky, a former UW-Whitewater sociology professor who is now with the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of the Fraser Valley in British Columbia. Dr. Vysotsky, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining the discussion today is Dr. Robert Futrell, a sociology professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Dr. Futrell, welcome to Route 51.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742 or email us at route51@wpr.org. Callers, please allow plenty of time for our producer to answer your call. Well, I'd like to start with a general explanation of what defines a hate group. So, Stanislav, what is the criteria that researchers use when determining which groups fall into this category?
Well, the criteria can actually vary depending on the researcher or the organization. However, I think you classify hate groups fairly well in your introduction in talking about organizations that generally view the world through a prism of superiority and domination. They see the world based on a biological or social hierarchy where their particular category to which they belong is superior and all other categories of human beings are inferior. And so they organize around this principle to build a society where they will maintain this kind of power through violence.
Racism, white supremacy, white nationalism, sometimes we use those terms interchangeably. They sound the same, but they're not really. Robert, can you explain the difference between those terms?
Well, I would put it in the context of thinking, especially if we're thinking about white supremacy, as that being the primary term to think through the lens back out to all those other terms. What's happened in the last few years, especially during the Trump presidency, but had been started long before that, was an attempt to sort of move away from, by some of these groups, to move away from the term white supremacy or neo-Nazi or the other monikers that really identify them as hate groups and try to scrub and sanitize their presentations. So notions like white nationalism don't shade so far into those old notions of white supremacy that we used to and that we still do think about in such vitriolic terms. Another sort of term in this conversation is alt-right, the most sanitized, in my view, of a term that really refers to a core principle that is white supremacy. So I think we need to see a lot of those terms sort of drawn back to their roots, and that root is white supremacy.
So it does. It sounds to me, and Stanislav, what are your thoughts? It sounds to me like these are all kind of versions of the same thing then.
Yeah, well, when we're talking about this particular category of movements, they are variations on the same theme to some extent. And they're really about framing and how the movement is trying to present itself to the wider world. So I would add to Robert's comment another term and another category that's used within this world is identitarianism, which is a very sanitized term because it to the average person, they wouldn't understand or know what identitarianism means, but it's a white supremacist belief in generating a world of, again, a biological difference, but now they're talking about it in terms of kind of identity politics and using this notion of claiming a white identity in a kind of multi-ethnic pluralist framework, but still for the purposes of white supremacy. So we have this process where these movements understand the political context they're operating in. And they know and understand that they are able to recruit better if they're not overtly using terms like white supremacist or even to some extent white nationalist, because people are going to bristle at the idea of joining a movement that is so overtly white supremacist in its framing.
Okay. I have to wonder, I know the Southern Poverty Law Center has been identifying these groups for a long time. Robert, how are they alerted to the presence of these groups? How do I find out about them? Do they have websites? Do they have publications? What is it?
There is a very robust subculture that has all of that and more. They hate groups, and if we're talking about white supremacy in particular, were one of the first political groups to become very, very savvy using the internet. They were one of the first adopters as it emerged, and they have been very effective at reaching out both domestically and globally to one another. And this is really important in the sense that it provides them this idea and a reality that there are others like us out there. And so it's kind of easy in some ways to track, especially over the internet, the rise and fall of groups. Now, it's tough to determine the extent of these groups. So when the SPLC counts, they may be counting, say, a website that is run by one person. It may be a website with thousands of people that are connected to it, say, like a Stormfront, which is one of the biggest white supremacist websites historically. So it's hard to know. You can count groups and you can count sites, but it's hard to know the numbers behind those.
And Stanislav, I saw you nodding your head as Robert was speaking. Did you want to add to what he said?
Yeah, I did, because in preparing for this program, I went and double checked the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate groups in Wisconsin and found that kind of methodological problem in the way in which they're looking at hate groups in Wisconsin. So if you look at those 15, of those 15 listed, there's at least two websites. So the Daily Stormer and The Right Stuff are websites. They're not groups per se. So what they're doing is they're recognizing that there are users on these sites who are in the state of Wisconsin. And that's a very different thing than talking about a formal organization of individuals.
It sounds like it's very difficult to quantify then exactly how active and how many members are really in these groups. I guess I'm really curious. There's been a sharp increase in the number of hate groups and hate crimes over the past few years. We alluded to this a little bit earlier, but what are some of the factors that led to those increases? Stanislav, what are your thoughts?
So in terms of the factors, I would say, primarily the culture that has arisen over the last 5 to 8 years. And we can trace back this culture to certain trends online and really see with incidents like Gamergate, which was really about gender and mobilization of men harassing women involved with video game reporting and in the video game industry. Gamergate opened up a space for people to express prejudice and express bigotry. And this was a movement, because of its misogyny, that also began to overlap with some of these more overtly white supremacist hate groups and created a new kind of style of online activism. So this is where we see some of the seeds laid for what we now kind of refer to as the alt-right. And following the Gamergate phenomenon, we had a significant shift in the public political discourse in the United States. And that shift cannot be separated from Donald Trump's candidacy and from Donald Trump's election to the presidency. When Donald Trump announced his candidacy, he did so using overtly prejudiced rhetoric, particularly against the Latinx community. And in that kind of candidacy, in his campaign that ran on a platform of economic nationalism, a lot of people involved in the supremacist movement saw somebody who was speaking their language. So they didn't, and they don't to this day, see Donald Trump as someone who is a member of the movement, but they see someone who opens up a political opportunity for them to be able to operate publicly and to speak publicly and to recruit publicly. And so the political climate that we have has been one that has increasingly demonstrated a toleration for supremacist ideas and for supremacist activity. So we see time and time again, people who are actively involved in national politics expressing support for supremacist activists, in particular when those supremacist activists are able to frame their activism as support for the Trump administration or support for conservative policies.
I realize this is a complicated question, but what is it that really draws people to these types of groups? What is it that they see in these groups? Robert, what do you think?
Well, you know, so my colleague Pete Seamy and I have done ethnographic research, which means we've been out in the field with these networks. And one of the things that people don't realize is the degree to which these groups provide camaraderie, fellow feeling, connection, sense of brotherhood and sisterhood to the people that are part of them. And so, you know, there is the ideology, and we all think about people tied to hate groups as true believers, committed to an ideology, but it's more complex than that. In some cases, the ideology is secondary to the social connections that people are making, and then through those social connections, they start to develop a sense of meaningfulness for their own lives, for their lives in connection to others, and of course, then that is translated through an ideology, a set of ideas of superiority, which can be you know, very very strengthening to many people, especially people who have felt in some ways alienated, shunned, isolated from the wider world. And so I think it's easy to imagine, and to some degree justified in some cases, folks connected to white supremacy as completely abhorrent, inhumane people, but they are humans like others. And so we have to actually understand what draws them to such vitriol, to such you know, marginalized perspectives in the broader world, and keeps them there, and a lot of that is the social connections that they find.
You're listening to Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky and Dr. Robert Futrell, a discussion on the resurgence of hate groups in Wisconsin. When we return, we'll talk about the ideology behind specific groups and where those groups may be operating today. You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742 or emailing questions and comments to Route51@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's getting better. Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone to blame. You said one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share it. It leaves you, baby, if you don't care for it.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky and Dr. Robert Futrell are here today for a discussion on hate groups operating in local communities. We'll take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call or email us at route51@WPR.org. The Ku Klux Klan isn't on the current list of hate groups in Wisconsin. They used to be. They are not right now. There are, however, widespread reports that there is an active chapter operating in the Mercer area in northern Wisconsin. There's a resident and local bar owner who is very open about admitting that he is a member, that he is a KKK Grand Dragon. Why are some of these groups not showing up on the current list? Stanislav, do you know?
So part of it might have to do with the way in which groups operate. And again, some of this methodology has to do with how public they are. So the Southern Poverty Law Center frequently is registering more public manifestations of hate groups. So if you're looking at a bar owner in Mercer, you are looking at somebody who's operating maybe in a little bit more of a private sense. So that might be one factor that he's not as publicly organizing. But the other factor here is one that has to do with the very notion of the Klan. And we have this vision of the Ku Klux Klan as a large, single, unitary organization. And that has historically been the case, certainly in the first and second waves of the Ku Klux Klan that occurred shortly after the Civil War, and then again at the start of the 20th century. But today's Klan is really a series of clans. So there are a number of different organizations that operate under the moniker of Ku Klux Klan. So if this particular individual refers to himself as a Klansman, he may not necessarily be associated with one of the major clans that is also on the radar of something like the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, that doesn't mean he's not a Klansman, because the way in which organization occurs among supremacist groups these days is highly decentralized. So it's very easy for individuals to become involved in hate groups and supremacist movements because they're able to simply declare themselves involved and declare themselves as members. And through that kind of declaration, you may be active, you may be involved, you may be spreading the message, but you may not necessarily come up on the radar of a large national watchdog organization.
Robert, how does recruitment happen? I mean, does somebody just like Stanislav was saying, just say I'm a Klansman or I'm a member of this. How does it happen?
Well, sometimes it works that way. Sure. I mean, it I think we have to go back and to play off what Stanislav was just saying. You know, we may have a sense that when we talk about the white supremacy movement, it's some kind of highly organized, directed from a top-down set of organizations. It doesn't look like that. It's much more about the networks and overlapping networks that move between, you know, what we would call white supremacy groups all over to, say, anti-government extremists, patriot movement, militia movement. It doesn't mean that any one group is all of one type or another, but the networks interact. And so you can claim affiliation very easily by connecting in a chat room on a website that is affiliated with, say, a white supremacy group. You may not run that website, and that's another step into being a part of the movement. But there's real broad gradations of involvement that can happen. And so in terms of recruitment, I mean, we've seen it happen in house parties. Some of those house parties, if you've ever been to a house party with a band and there's music happening and the band takes a break and then, you know, the next set starts and all of a sudden they've taken off their jackets and there's neo-Nazi insignia on and people start talking to folks who are new to the group and start relating a particular vision of the world, asking them if they face problems in their lives and then translating those through a white supremacist point of view. Now, that doesn't mean anybody that is engaged in that way then becomes a white supremacist, but they're able to pick off people. And like I said, a lot of that is pulling them into networks where they feel a sense of belonging and a sense of camaraderie and a sense of meaning. The other thing that I would say is that there's this notion that people become self-radicalized through the internet. You'll see this idea a lot. And I really don't like that notion because it suggests that people are simply isolated, taking in information and then acting upon it. Dylann Roof is often characterized like this. But what they're doing is actually entering a social sphere. It might be a virtual sphere, but they're entering a social world that's been created and maintained and inside interactions with other people that is very, very similar to what happens in face-to-face real world settings. And so there's no self-radicalization. There's an attempt to radicalize others within a sphere of interaction. It could be virtual. It could be face-to-face. And it's often both.
Stanislav, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I want to say that I absolutely agree with that dynamic. And the same thing holds for people who we refer to as a lone actor or lone wolf perpetrators of violence. So when we look at any number of recent mass shooting incidents affiliated with the supremacist movement, we often think of these things. So Robert mentioned Dylann Roof, right? We think of Dylann Roof as just this individual who did this thing because he had these crazy ideas. But the reality is that Dylann Roof was deeply embedded in a network of ideas and deeply embedded in a movement. And we certainly see that more recently with incidents like the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, which we just passed the two-year anniversary. We certainly saw that with the shooting at Walmart in Texas, that you have individuals who may be acting alone, but they're not people who are simply individuals who've come up with this idea on their own. There's a whole network of people encouraging them, giving them advice, talking about the kinds of weapons they're going to use. So, for example, the researcher Mark Hamm, he has been tracing the specific weapons used by supremacist mass shooters and noticed there's a pattern that they like to use the same weapon over and over again. And that's happening because there's a culture of people who are exalting certain kinds of weapons. So what we're talking about here are people who are operating in a world of mass encouragement. And so to think of them as lone wolf or lone actor is really kind of a disservice, honestly, to the extent of the world of supremacy they're operating in.
When we look at the specific movements that are officially represented in Wisconsin, we talked about white nationalist groups. There are also a couple of groups that identify as neo-Nazi, the New Order, for example. How's the neo-Nazi group defined? How do they differ from other hate groups? Robert?
Well, they typically explicitly take up the ideas of course, Adolf Hitler, the Third Reich, and Nazism generally. They see that as a form of power, a historical legacy. But in terms of basic ideology, it doesn't differ all that much. It's sort of how the presentation, the style, and I would just to go back to you talking about the Ku Klux Klan earlier. I mean, one way to roughly distinguish white supremacy groups is, you know, there's the traditional groups that we think of, and a lot of neo-Nazi groups would fit in there: neo-Confederates, Ku Klux Klan, even Hammerskins, which are prevalent near you all or were, and more recently, as Stanislav said, Identitarians or the group Atom Waffen, the Rise Above movement, and they really take on an interesting and different style. For instance, the Rise Above movement is a very clean cut sort of MMA style group that is very interesting to a lot of young men, right? And so each group, I think, in some ways is strategically trying to determine what will be interesting and compelling to the types of recruits that they seek. Now, some neo-Nazi groups, such as the National Socialists, in an effort to rebrand, right, when Trump was elected in 2016, told its followers, we're doing away with the swastika, which was a part of its quote-unquote uniform for a very, very long time. And the strategy was, we are not changing our ideology, we're changing our look. We're scrubbing and making ourselves more palatable to help recruitment.
New Order, which we've been talking about here, a neo-Nazi group based in Milwaukee, they call their members heirs of Adolf Hitler. They support an all-white society. And on their website, they say they're committed to building a better world for future generations of their race. They decry mindless materialism, drugs, pollution, pornography, race mixing, filth, chaos. But Martin Kerr, who is New Order's chief of staff, claims this is not a hate group. Is it common for groups like this to claim they're not hate-based, Stanislav? I mean, is this something that they all say, hey, we're not a hate group, we're actually about clean living or you know, some other ideal that they're trying to create?
Yes, absolutely. And this goes back to the point I made earlier about framing and about presentation of the group and the way in which they message. So most groups understand the social and cultural environment that they're operating in. And they understand that social and cultural environment is one that has placed, as Robert and his colleagues, Pete Simi, have pointed out, a stigma on being an overt member of a supremacist group. You can't just walk around and say that, you know, you're a white supremacist or a neo-Nazi or express the kinds of bigotry that are the core to their belief systems. And so they realize that because this is an ineffective strategy, they look to other ways to present themselves that are going to be more palatable to the general public. And one of those ways is to invert the relationship where people refer to them as hate groups and they say, well, we don't hate anybody. We love our race. We love our people. You know, this is why the quote from New Order is a variation on the 14-word slogan, which is, we must secure the existence of our people in a future for white children, right? This doesn't sound hateful. This sounds positive, and it sounds like a positive presentation of the group. So they're doing these kinds of active strategies, and they use two active strategies in particular when they're talking about this kind of framing. And one of them is referred to as ethnic claims making, where they say that they're just, you know, people who are advocating for white people in the same way that, say, the NAACP advocates for African Americans, or the Anti-Defamation League advocates for Jewish people. So they're just one of a multiple group number of ethnic organizations in a pluralist society. And then the other, and both of these were identified by Mitch Burberry, is intellectualism. So they will use pseudo-intellectual, pseudo-scientific arguments to justify their ideology and their position, and explain their belief system through a kind of philosophical or scientific rhetoric.
So we've talked a lot about white nationalists, white supremacists, but I need to point out that in Wisconsin, there are also a handful of Black separatist groups that are identified as hate groups. When I think about hate groups, I think about the white supremacists first and foremost. So Robert, can you explain what is the Black separatist movement, and why is that classified as a hate group?
Well, I have to say that's not where I tend to focus my attention research wise, but I think the SPLC would say that they're classifying, like Stanislaw said earlier, any group that evinces some claims of superiority based on ethnic or racial background. And so I don't have the list in front of me that the SPLC has for Wisconsin, but my guess is that they are classifying them on those grounds in order to be ecumenical and broad in the ways that they're, talking about hate, not just focusing solely on white supremacy.
And if I could,
yes.
Oh, sorry. If I could speak to that as well,
yes.
Specifically looking at, because I've got this in front of me, the group that is classified as Black separatist, and there appears to be only one in Wisconsin, is called the Israelite School of Universal Practical Knowledge. And generally, the certain variations on Black Israelism are ones that are constructed as viewing people of African descent as being the essentially the people of the Bible. And they frequently see white people as being inherently evil. And in particular, they're frequently deeply anti-Semitic. And so this may be why this particular group is being categorized as a hate group. Although there have been people who have very much critiqued the inclusion of certain kinds of Black nationalist groups in the Southern Poverty Law Center's categories, because they often see them as drawing false equivalencies between groups that are marginalized in the society and represent populations of people who cannot achieve domination or dominant status, as opposed to these more kind of white supremacist groups that represent a popular kind of majority and have political and social and economic power.
Thank you for that explanation. You're listening to Dr. Stanislaw Vysotsky and Dr. Robert Futrell, a discussion on the resurgence of hate groups in Wisconsin. When we return, a look at what the future might hold for these groups and how members who want to leave finally do. You can join the conversation too by calling 800-780-9742 or email questions and comments to Route51@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Can you hear me rise? I'm from the crown. Can't count it out. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky and Dr. Robert Futrell are our guests today for a discussion on hate groups operating in North Central Wisconsin and throughout the state. We'll take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. You can email us, too, at route51@wpr.org. Robert, I'm curious if it's difficult for members of these groups to separate themselves, to leave the fold, so to speak, if their ideologies begin to change, or is it kind of like a gang? Once you're in, you're in.
It's variable, but I would say it is gang-like in some instances. And I would say that in other instances, people do exit. There are groups such as Life After Hate, for instance, who are helping those folks who reach out to take those steps to exit those groups when possible. You know, one of the things that's really interesting, and research is starting to show that even when stepping out of these groups, some members, and it varies on the number of years and time spent in the groups, but some members are show an addiction to hate in the sense that when they're out, they have to do the same sorts of work that drug addicts have to do to keep themselves from thinking about or acting on hateful ideas that they've been deeply socialized into within these networks. You think of the idea of echo chamber and the degree to which some people are tied into a worldview, and a worldview that when constantly produced and sort of held onto can, you know, get deep inside the ways that one sees the world, even when one is rejecting those ideas. And so, yes, it's possible to get out. It happens very frequently. Sometimes it happens at a particular life stage when they have kids and think about responsibilities and so forth, but not always. But even when getting out, it's hard to, for many, some of them to reject the ideas that they've been deeply socialized into.
It almost sounds like an addiction of sorts, that they have a difficult time shaking those thoughts. Stanislav, is there hope for these people? I mean, can they get past it?
Yeah, there's certainly hope because, of course, anyone can move out of these groups. It very much varies the degree to which they're involved. So as Robert points out, it has to do with how long they're in and also what type of group there or organization or movement sector. So in my own work, I talk about movement sectors. So if you're involved in, for example, what I refer to as the subcultural sector, and this is where we'd put like racist skinheads or National Socialist black metal or other kinds of more youth-oriented subcultures, you frequently see a lot of turnaround. So people will kind of drop into this thing. They'll be involved in it for anything from like 6 months to a couple of years, and then they'll drop out and sometimes potentially very actively change sides and become active anti-racists as well, because there are differing factions within these kinds of subcultures. So it's hard to also quantify kind of how many former members there are out there as well, because for certainly a lot of people I've met in my research, they've gone through a quote unquote Nazi phase. You know, it's something that they, you know, dabbled with or experimented with or got involved with and regret. So people certainly do change. And even for some of the most hardcore and active members, we've certainly seen leaders both locally and nationally and internationally leave the movement. But it is, as Robert points out, a very complex process and one that requires frequently an extensive support network. And that's probably one of the key factors is having some sort of support network that is able to provide an alternative to the support network that these supremacist movements had in the past, that encourages people to move away from not just the movement, because one could drop out of the movement and not change their beliefs. But if you're looking at changing beliefs, you have to have a network of people who are going to support you in that change of beliefs and ideology and give you, you know, positive rewards and a sense of belonging and meaning, and that that change in ideology is a positive step.
Robert, when I was researching for this program, I came upon the term the sociology of racism. So what is that really? And is there, what can we learn from that?
Well, I mean, that's a certainly a broad field with broad subdiscipline within our field. I mean, we learn all the ways that racism historically and at present have underlied our institutions and our daily practices. So, you know, we're can be argued a racist society in many ways. We've owned slaves, and there's still a lot of problems that pull from that. And we've seen it emerge in the last presidency. And we're talking about the rise of hate groups based on white supremacy right now. So it's not vanishing anytime soon. And so we can also learn, I think, not only the causes and the examples, but we can, that helps us think about what to do about it, which is, you know, the question everybody comes to in the end. And I don't know if we're going to talk about that to close sure. out or not, but, you know, that's the question I'm sure Stanislav always gets. I always get when we talk about this topic. And one of the sub questions of that is, well, gosh, these horrible people, can't we just arrest them, or can't we just shut them down? And that's a tough issue. You know, how much should a democratic society tolerate from white supremacists or other extremists? And what exactly does extremism mean, right? The old saying is that one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So doing things like arresting to eradicate white supremacists always pushes against those constitutional protections of free speech, free assembly, freedom from surveillance, privacy rights. Of course, when laws are broken, you know, anyone can be dealt with legally, but white supremacists particularly have long been really savvy at sort of pushing a line and knowing precisely when to stay on the legal side. There's other ways to deal with deplatforming from websites but I think I would just say right now to be an advocate or an ally when other groups are attacked, you know, to stand up for them creates reciprocal kind of mutual supports. And it's hard. I'd say, you know, every moment of hate and violence is a moment for a community to respond. And many of these people are inside these networks because they found a sense of community. And they can leave those networks or never enter those networks if they find a powerful sense of community outside of hate, violence, and the fantastical visions of superiority that these groups promote.
Well, I guess you bring up a good point here. What is the line between free speech and hate speech? Where do we draw that line? What do you think, Robert?
Well, there's legal definition, so we've you know, authorities have drawn it. But that legal definition often or almost always doesn't meet any individual's typical standard. This is why it's so tough, because what one person thinks is the line another person may think is not close. And so we debate that. But we have legal definitions of that. And that's when authorities can step in. What many people or anti-racists want is to step in sometimes long before that, because they think the line has been drawn in the wrong place, the legal.
I'd like to build on a point that Robert made too. He was talking about the ways that we can counter the spread of hate groups and white supremacist ideology. Those attempts have mostly relied on legislation and regulation of social media. Stanislav, what do you think that policymakers can learn from sociological science as they look for solutions?
So some of the things that we can learn beyond simply thinking about these kinds of notions of regulation is understanding the importance of having collective and superordinate goals. And so one of the things that politicians need to do, particularly politicians who want to build kind of coalitions of people, is to think about the way in which universal policies bring people together. So the bringing in policies that are going to unite people rather than divide people, providing things that people feel like they're missing, particularly to some extent materially. You know, one of the major wedge issues for this movement is inequality, structural inequality, economic inequality. You know, if we look at the hate map and we look at where hate groups are concentrated, I always ask my students when I do this in a lesson, you know, what stands out in this map? And my students all focus on the South. And then I have to point them to the Rust Belt. You know, I point them to this stream from the Mid-Atlantic all the way into the Midwest of hate groups. And I say, look at the structural conditions here. This is the part of the country that's become deindustrialized. This is the part of the country where people feel like they're hurting economically. And so if politicians can work to address those feelings, those feelings of economic strain and frustration, that is a major way of building unity and coalitions across categories of people.
Robert, what do you think? What do you think policymakers should do about this issue?
Well, I like what Stanislav said about sort of universal policies. I mean, you know, the only way to combat racism, anti-Semitism, misogyny, hate is to really address and combat all forms of hate. What we see in the propaganda is very rarely do white supremacists hate any one person. They abstract out and advocate a collective position that we can meet with a stronger collective response. And I would just go back to this notion that there's nothing more powerful than the idea of community. And so white supremacists are a community of sorts, but those of us opposed are much larger and much more powerful. So I think we need to commit to developing that community, developing mutually supportive, diverse people bent on inclusion rather than exclusion, more peaceful than conflictual, ultimately more healthy in all the ways we think about health, mentally, physically, and spiritually than presently exists. That's easy to say. And at this moment, the division we're facing in this country make it very, very hard to maybe imagine, you know, but democracy is a messy process and it's a long-term effort. And I think with the broader goals of universality in mind and a strong community, I think we can get there. It's just...
Yes. Thank you both for this fascinating discussion. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Once again, thanks to our guests, Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky and Dr. Robert Futrell. Our executive producer and on-air producer today is Rick Ryer. Our producers are Kate Spranger and Joy Ratchkramer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Johnny Cash, Thousand Foot Crutch, Switchfoot, Skillet, and Todd Rundgren. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll explore the science of sleep. What is a sleep study used for, and what can it tell us about our health? If you have questions for our guests or an idea for a future program, email us at route51@WPR.org. Until next week, we're heading out of town. Calling out to the planet.